Hey there, welcome to SaaS Unbound Podcast. I'm your host, Anna Dana, Head of Growth at SaaS Group, serial acquirer buying wonderful SaaS businesses to take them to the next level. And here I chat with inspiring founders and experts to get an inside scoop on how they made their business a success. So today with me is Juan, CEO of Bupost, global investment bank for profitable software companies and marketplaces, providing M&A services powered by unique data infrastructure. Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for hosting me.
Sure, absolutely. I mean, like I said, this is powered by SaaS Group, so we love talking M&A and how exiting works for founders and like what different acquirers or brokers or experts see on the market. So, you know, before we get there, maybe let's start with your story and like how you got to build Bupost in the first place.
Totally. Well, for my whole life, I've been working in M&A. I started fresh from school at Merrill Lynch. I spent a couple of years there. Then I moved to private equity, doing M&A for like traditional businesses, your ice cream factory, food catering, all these type of explosives as well. So like really varied stuff. And that was very interesting because I learned how to structure deals and how to buy a business, what to look into, etc. And then I joined a company called Cabify as a co-founder and CFO. Cabify is like Uber for Spain and Latin America. So it was an exciting ride as well, because I learned how to be an operator, how to get close to operations, to technology, how to build tech and so on. And then in 2020, I decided that I wanted to kind of be behind the wheel rather than being the co-pilot or the CFO. And that's why I started Bupost. In the beginning, my thought was to exactly roll up e-commerce businesses. It was the times of the Thrasios of the world and so on. And I found it really interesting that you could just pull data out of the Amazon marketplace and decide based on that data. And that was my first attempt. But in the last minute, one of my investors pulled the plug because the space started to look a little bit crowded. And so I was left without financing. And I decided to pivot, and we started lending on acquisitions. So we partnered with people like Acquire.com, Flippa, all these brokers that had a huge number of companies for sale. We pre-approved those businesses, and you could buy them out by using half of our money plus some money that you put down. We've been doing that for like 4 years at Bupost. Then over time, we learned that it was a very capital intensive business. We needed to raise a lot of money that was unfortunately not available in the market. And we decided to kind of pause that. We still have a portfolio of around 30 million, mostly SaaS businesses, small sizes, anywhere between 1 million and 3 million mostly. And yeah, we started doing M&A advisory, which, by the way, we're going to spin it off and do it under a separate branding now called L40, mostly for tech M&A. So I would say that very interesting story in terms of pivoting many times, but always around the M&A space. So I got to learn a lot of things around M&A from very different perspectives.
That's pretty cool. So, you know, kids wanted to work in the ice cream factory, and now kids want to sell ice cream factories. So you actually did that. That's pretty cool. So yeah, I think you're right. It's kind of like a natural unfolding of like M&A, but kind of addressing what's going on the market. All right. I want to let you know, kind of jump into it right away, right? Because, you know, with SaaS Group, we do always recommend to have somebody on the side, on your side as a founder, to kind of, you know, hold your hand, explain the processes, also be very empathic in the process, because it's lonely, it's stressful. And, you know, having a person that's been there and done that kind of really helps you understand what is going on and what will happen to you. So, okay, so why do you think, that's our opinion, right? Why do you think founders need an expert on their side, and how to find a good one?
Yes, I think the main reason why you want to have an advisor is, I mean, you could hear that you might want to optimize pricing, you might want to create competitive tension and so on. That's definitely true. But I would say that the most important reason why you want to have an advisor is because selling your business is something that will happen probably once in your lifetime, maybe a few times if you're a serial entrepreneur. And crossing it is like crossing a minefield. So if you step in the wrong place, the deal just goes bust, and you don't want that. So if you have someone who's been through that many times and can understand the risks, can manage relationships, can put a little bit of peace when things go sour and so on, chances are you're going to be selling your business much more successfully than if you don't have that type of advisory, especially if you haven't done that before. And it's interesting because we work also with private equity firms that have this very seasoned experts in M&A, obviously. They wouldn't need advisory if you think of their expertise, but they still hire advisors. And there's a good reason for that. It's like an intermediary, someone that helps run the process. There's always nuances to what an M&A process is. And you always want to have someone by your hand who is specialist in that.
Yeah, absolutely. So how do we choose the right one?
And that's a very good question. I think there's no good advisor and bad advisor. It's just the fit of your business to your advisor. So I would say, first of all, I would look into someone who has expertise in the specific sector or even subsector of your business. So if you're selling an HR tech company, you might want to make sure that the advisor that you're engaging has credentials and experience and has closed deals in that particular space, because they will know the buyers, they will have the contacts, and it's going to be much easier. That's one thing. Second, size. I think size is important. You want to make sure that you engage with, you don't engage with Morgan Stanley for selling a very small business. This is going to say no. But also, if you want to sell a 50 million business, you don't want to go with a marketplace, for example, because in the end, marketplaces tend to focus on or have more like individual buyers that will buy very successfully smaller businesses. So that's also important. And I think that the third thing that I always say is the feeling. You have to make sure that you're going to work with someone you like to work with, because in the end, you're going to spend perhaps 3 months, maybe 12 months. It's going to be a long time working with that person. So you have to make sure there's kind of alignment in working together in a very intensive project.
Yeah, that makes great sense. I was talking to a founder the other day, and you know, they were saying that for smaller deals, like you said, like $1 to $10 million, $1 to $5 million in ARR, a lot of founders, they want to be a little more hands-on in the process, but also there is a great lack of information and how it goes. And, you know, I feel like when you are selling 50 million, 100 million, or whatever, bigger business, you don't really need to know that much, because yes, there are advisors, and like the process is just so complicated that you won't be able to kind of be there anyway. But if you are a founder of a smaller SaaS, yeah, you kind of want to still drive it. So my question is, like, as advisors, what kind of the most common questions that you were asked by founders? Like, what is the thing that is most misunderstood and they need help with?
What you're saying is interesting, because we work mostly with businesses that are in the 2 to 10 million ARR range. That's, I would say, our sweet spot. And there's a reason for that. In the end, most advisors tend to go up market as they scale and as time passes. So there's like an orphan space there in which we can definitely help. Most of the people we work with haven't sold a business before. They're founders. They're really good at. They're generally product people that at some point in time they feel that they need to scale the business, but they don't. Maybe they don't want to hire a sales team, or they feel that they don't have the skills or whatever. And they're ready to sell. And they do have a lot of questions. They're generally very coachable, and they're willing to learn. I like it a lot, because they will want to sell another business in the future, and they will ask a lot of questions. So it's a lot of interaction in both ways, which is really good. So specific questions that these people ask. First of all, I'm incorporated in XYZ country. Will that be a problem if I want to sell to an American? Because they generally buy assets instead of shares, and they don't want to own, say, a Bulgarian entity or a Polish entity. That's something that I get asked a lot. And what I say is that maybe it would have been better if you had incorporated in the US, but I think that won't be, if your business is good, that won't be an issue. What else? There's always a debate of whether we should engage with someone like SAS Group or perhaps try to seek an exit to a strategic buyer, and they want to learn what's the difference and what are the advantages and disadvantages of each avenue. So yeah, those questions we get asked a lot.
And what do you see, like, when founders come to you? They usually come when there are already a few buyers in line, like coming to talk to them, or do you still kind of advise them on, you know, where to go looking?
That's a very good question as well. We get engaged with people at all stages. So we sometimes see people that are in early stages. They don't want to sell. They will want to sell in 5 years from now. But they still want to learn a little bit about the process, and that they know that at some point in time they will need an exit. And so we work with those people over time. Most of, I would say, perhaps 70 to 80% of the people come to us when they think they're ready to sell, but they're still undecided. And they want to figure out whether their timing is right or they should just hold on for 1 year. And what we tell them is that, in general, there's a very emotional component of selling your business. So there's no right or wrong time. It's mostly about you. We can tell them, obviously, that the market is good or the market is bad and so on. And that gives them additional info. But there's a very kind of, say, internal component in deciding whether you want to sell or not. And then sometimes we get people that come to us and say, hey, you know, we got these guys that put an offer on the table. Do you think I should take it? Do you think I should wait? Is this a good offer? We don't know much. Maybe my business is worth much more or not, and so on. And I would say that's perhaps 20% of the time.
All right. So when you advise them, you know, whether to engage with somebody like SAS Group or, you know, look for a strategic acquirer, like, what does it depend on?
This episode is sponsored by Rewardful. Looking for new ways to find customers for your SaaS business? Consider building an affiliate program. Rewardful is the easiest affiliate tracking platform to set up, manage, and scale for SaaS companies. Building a successful affiliate program can be a little bit intimidating at first, and that's why Rewardful has taken what they've observed from their most successful customers' affiliate programs and distilled that into an exclusive online course. The exciting part? Their affiliate marketing course is absolutely free. Start the course at academy.rewardful.com. Academy.rewardful.com. And turn your biggest fans into your best marketers.
That's a good question. Again, the objectives of what you want to achieve are very important. In the end, with someone like SAS Group, you generally have like a good home for your business, but they might expect you to continue running the business for a while. And correct me if I'm wrong, but I think that's the kind of the spirit, right? You find a good home for your business, but then you continue running it, you build it, you scale it, you nurture it with a good partner. Whereas if you sell to a strategic buyer, you just get rid of the thing. They will just put the resources. They do whatever whatever they want with it, and you just forget about it. Sometimes you might optimize pricing. Or upfront pricing. But on the other hand, maybe that's not what you want to achieve. You'd just rather cash out some, but you're engaged. You like to be part of a bigger organization that can help you perhaps scale sales and et cetera. So again, it will depend on the particular objectives of the seller.
Yeah, absolutely. And I really like what you said about, you know, this internal kind of reasoning for selling a company, because we talk about this a lot. Like, a lot of founders are thinking about timing the market, and everyone's kind of like on hold this year because last year was a little bit shaky in M&A. So now everyone's like, okay, maybe this year is the year to sell. Even though maybe last year they also wanted to do it, but couldn't because, the conditions on the market might not be as favorable. So, I kind of also want to ask you, like, what is the usual picture that you see when founders come to you? Is it, you know, how difficult is it actually for founders to come to you when and try to sell when it's still growing and it's, you know, on the peak? Or is it usually like okay, we've tried to time the market for a couple of years and it didn't really work and we exhausted our own resources and now, okay, it's time to do it. And maybe it's not the most favorable either.
I think it depends a lot. In the end, it's somehow easier to time the sale based on what you see on your own business than what you're seeing on the market, because markets turn around very quickly. There's a turning point and then you miss the wave. So it's really hard to tell when is the right time to sell based on what you're seeing in the market. But you know your business very well. Obviously, you're the owner, you're the seller. You know what's good, you know what's not so good about it. And you're generally able to predict how much you're going to grow in the next year, in the next 2 years, and so on. So what I generally advise is let someone else take the last penny. You will be much more successful in selling a business that is growing at rates of at least 20%. You don't have to sell, or you could also sell if your business is growing a little bit less. But your chances of succeeding are going to be much more than if you have a stagnant business that has, I mean, there's uncertainties on where it is headed. So that's generally the advice I give people. But again, there are a lot of nuances to that, because you might enjoy running your business and it might add additional value for you to keep running it for 1 year more, even if you don't optimize the price and the business kind of starts flattening out a little bit. That would be my advice if you want to optimize price and chances of succeeding.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's I want to ask you about, you know, timing the market and actually like looking at what's going on with valuations and, you know, the prices. And, you know, benchmarking is, again, a bit of a like shaky topic. Like, should we look at the benchmarks and how relevant are they for my particular company? And, you know, I just keep repeating that phrase that Pavel Prokofiev, our head of M&A, said, that, you know, valuations are science, but also an art. So like, how much of an art is it actually? And can you accurately predict the price for your SaaS, or, you know, without really engaging with the few buyers, it's not that possible?
I would say that the beauty of the market, or the market segment we're working on, which is again the smaller mid-market or the lower mid-market, is that there are a lot of opportunities of arbitrage. Because in the end, there's limited data available and there's lack of transparency, which means that if you're good at it, you might end up selling really well. If you're good at it on the other side, you might end up buying really well. And so there are a lot of opportunities of using this asymmetry of information to get good deals, which means that it's also very relevant to obviously engage with people who know the space really well and know what's going on. We definitely look at all benchmarks. And what I can tell you is that, for example, this is a very good moment for selling. It's more like a seller market at this stage. In 2025, we foresee that that's going to be the case for the next 12 months, because essentially we got obviously the SaaS groups of the world acquiring businesses, but we also have a lot of strategics that have added M&A as their core strategy. So that's what we're seeing now in the market, and that is relevant, because in the end, if you're selling a business, regardless of how it looks like, you're going to get a lot of competitive tension, and that's going to drive the price up. Now, there's a lot of components or intrinsic components of the business that will drive valuation up or down. Like, do you need to revamp the product to continue running the business? Is this an enterprise business, or is it like SMB? Rule of 40, obviously, metrics. There are quite a few metrics that you can use for benchmarking and benchmark against the market and get a sense of where you're going to land on. But then there's a lot of, I would say, qualitative elements that will impact valuation. And that's where the ad comes. And that's not so much about running a valuation and crunching numbers. It's more about running the process and discovering what you're going to get at the end of it.
Yeah. Thanks for elaborating. So what are the most kind of common mistakes that founders make when, you know, when they go at it, especially without an advisor?
I think the most common mistake is just not being coachable and not accepting feedback. And so we've seen people that they want to sell, but they want to sell at X price. And so we tell them, look, that's not going to be possible. You might want to find another advisor that will tell you it's possible, but we can't work like that. We want to make sure that we have a trust, I would say a two-way trust relationship with them. And so if we tell them that the market is XYZ, we want them to understand it. And obviously, let us know what we want to do on their, what he wants us to do on their behalf. But on the other hand, they should trust that. Trust us and go hand by hand. And so when there's no possibility of building that kind of relationship, we just don't engage with sellers.
Okay. Yeah, I think it makes sense. Sometimes, you know, it's not about just hearing what you want to hear about your business and kind of like get compliments for it. But I think you're right. It's just kind of an honest conversation of what you can get. And obviously you can get very lucky, like you said, but yeah, I think getting a few opinions really makes sense here. So since you started talking about, you know, 2025 and how good of a market it is, I actually have a few of your predictions here for 2024. And it was first online marketing agencies booming, e-commerce changing hands triggered by financial distress, SaaS always in demand, especially B2B, and the special interest on iOS and Android apps. So how much was it true, like in your eyes?
Okay, I think it was a strong year for SaaS, perhaps not in terms of valuations, especially at the beginning, but I think that there was a lot of demand for SaaS businesses. And then in the latest part of the year, we've seen the prices go up. So I think that one, I got it right. Then I would also say that the e-commerce thing was also true because we saw a lot of distressed assets changing hands and all these opportunistic buyers just taking over for a penny and running them. We haven't seen that much transactionality in agencies. We've seen a few, but that was just perhaps a niche type of thing. So I don't think we got that one really right. And then the last one, which was iOS and Android apps, I think that's still a niche play. We see a few buyers buying into that space, but given that many of them are B2C and they're kind of harder to understand and to predict, it's generally harder to buy or to play that game.
Okay. All right. So anything for 2025? Well, like let's do this yearly and see what came true.
I think, the SaaS prediction is a safe bet. It's always a safe bet. I think it's been there for the past 20 years. But especially for 2025 and 2026, I think valuations are going to be attractive for sellers. It's going to be a seller market in the SaaS space. And I would say that at this stage, that's our bread and butter. That's where we focus. Other than that, we are seeing a lot of interest in transactional type of businesses, like tech businesses that run with a marketplace model or in the payments space. All these businesses seem to be very attractive now, especially if they have, a SaaS component, but also on top, they're adding a transactional component, a payments processing component in a specific vertical. That's a trend that we're seeing right now. I don't know whether it's going to continue through the whole 2025. But that's an asset class that's going to be interesting. And I also see that a lot of, perhaps because you guys are being very successful, but we see a lot of strategic buyers digging into kind of smaller assets now. You had all these HubSpots and Salesforces of the world buying billion-dollar businesses every 5 years. And now they have this thinking that they need to kind of improve their product offering and add additional, perhaps, products to their platform by buying smaller 20, 50 million dollar assets on a more regular basis. And I think that's going to be something that's going to happen in 2025.
Oh, thank God we got more competition. It almost got too easy for us. But okay, those are cool predictions. Thank you. I wrote them down. So, you know, let's see what plays out next year. But let's also talk about your rebranding. Like you decided to go up market. Tell me more about this. Like what's the decision about and who are you working with now?
That's an interesting one. In the end, with Bupos, we focused a lot on the smaller segment, generally below 5 million in terms of deal value, because we wanted to have a diversified portfolio of loans and help people acquire these smaller assets in which transparency and liquidity is much harder to get. Over time, we started also offering opportunistically M&A, and we learned that M&A services work much better if the average ticket is bigger. We have the experience, we've been there, we've done this before. We know, obviously, the tech space really well, and we thought it was low-hanging fruit for us to start working on purely M&A advisory. And I think in the end, we're mostly operators rather than tech people. We built a tech platform that worked really well for lending and so on. But we're much better at advising and giving a personal touch to the process rather than just operating a marketplace or a platform like Flippa does very successfully. And we thought our natural space was more in the I would say, advisory business. So bigger tickets and so on. And for that, by the way, we're spinning it off completely. It's Manuel, Ignacio, and myself, the three senior guys at the company who are kind of starting a new one. And we're leaving just Bupos for running the loan portfolio, which will continue to repay for at least a couple of years. So we will run both things in parallel.
Okay, that's very interesting. And you guys are also going to do it globally, right? Because Bupos, like, tell me how it works, maybe in partnership, because Bupos has offices in the US as well, and you guys are all over Europe. So are you kind of spreading out and will be working in both North America and Europe, or how will it work?
That's definitely one of our core values. In the end, we're helping European companies sell to US buyers and vice versa. And that gives them a whole world of exposure to buyers. That's very valuable. So yes, we will continue doing that in both North America and Europe. We have an office in Madrid, we have an office in Lisbon, we have an office in Miami that will definitely continue into L4E.
That's awesome. All right. Well, one question that I cannot not ask, right, because it's there and it's AI for M&A. And I guess maybe we can split it in two. So first of all, how do you see acquirers' interest in AI companies? So is it really that everyone now wants an AI label on a company that they're buying? Or is it more of a cautious approach?
I would say that there's a lot of interest in AI companies in the VC world. So we got a lot of people funding pre-seed and seed AI businesses of all flavors, trying to achieve very different missions. So you got the infrastructure plays and the bigger players, but also the use case type of thing. But we're not seeing that much in the M&A world, because the businesses that are maturing now started early on and they didn't have that AI component at inception, and they built a successful product without the need of AI. It's obviously, there's always a question around, is your product going to be disrupted by AI? And that's part of the analysis of buyers, because sometimes if the product is not strong enough with no code tools and AI, you could perhaps replace and solve some of your smaller customers will just ditch the product. But that's not generally a topic that's deterring M&A at all. And I don't think AI is a driver for M&A in the segment that we're operating now at this stage. Maybe in 5 years from now, when all these seeded businesses, VC seeded businesses mature, we will see a lot of M&A around AI. And we will also see who were the winners and who were the losers of this wave.
Right. Just like with COVID. Okay. And so another part of this question, I guess, is how, if there is any way you are using AI for M&A, like, I don't know, with valuations or, you know, figuring out the metrics that are important. So is AI also entering M&A space?
You know, I think we have different opinions here in-house. So my partner, Ignacio, is very fond of AI and he's trying to embed it in the whole process. But sometimes I feel that perhaps the technology is not mature enough to help a very unique process or a very tailored process like M&A, in which there are a lot of different nuances. The way you communicate can affect everything. So I think it's good that we have it kind of, or we test it and see how it works and compare to what we would have done and see whether there are chances of improving the whole process. But at this stage, I don't think it's a driver of the way we run our business. So we're testing things, but yeah, not definitely not letting the AI take the driver's seat or even the co-pilot seat.
Okay. All right. Not yet. All right. Yeah, I think, you know, we also have different opinions at SaaS Group. I mean, we are exploring it and, you know, not for M&A directly, but for other brands that we're running. And, you know, some of the GMs and CEOs, they're like full on, not just the driver's seat. They're like, you know, they gave AI the full power over it. And they enjoy it. And we, you know, we find new revenue generation streams with AI as well. And some are a bit more skeptical and they're like, okay, we'll let everyone else do that. But for us, we'll have to find, you know, where the value is with AI for our customers first before we even try implementing anything.
Interesting. Yeah, I think this is a debate in all organizations at the moment. You got the Klarnas of the world that, again, have just given up everything to AI. And if you don't know AI, you just can't be part of the organization. You got the skepticals. And I think we're more or less perhaps closer to the skepticals, but more or less in between, I would say.
Okay. All right. We'll see how it plays out. But okay, I have just a couple more questions for you, the usuals here. And the first one is, you know, what is the biggest win and the biggest failure for you with Bupos and, you know, now with rebranding maybe as well? Is there anything that really stood out?
I think the biggest win is that we helped a lot of people acquire small businesses and they succeeded at being acquirers. And perhaps they would have never done it without us. We gave them money, but we also gave them the confidence to complete their acquisitions. And that's important because I feel developing the M&A world from, I would say, the seed or the smaller segment is important if we want to build something that lasts in the future. I think that our biggest failure is that we were unable to raise sufficiently meaningful capital to build it to scale. I would have loved to build something that was huge, but we hit two things. First of all, we hit the boundaries of the market because I feel the segment, the smaller M&A segment, is perhaps too restricted for a lending business. And second, obviously, the biggest pool of capitals that are needed for a lending business are just not there. So that's why we were unable to scale. But I think that the portfolio is really good. The people who have worked with us are really happy about the product. And that's probably something that, again, no regrets. I think we did something that was really useful for many people.
Perfect. Well, great learning and probably a very good pivot. Yeah, okay. The last one is about a hack and can be any hack. It can be a hack for founders to, you know, to find their best buyer fit. It can be a hack to, you know, to pivoting. It can be a hack to entering the US market. Anything that works for you and you're willing to share with other founders.
Wow, you got me with that one. I gotta think about it a little. A hack. I would say your guys at Roll Up Europe produce very interesting content for the M&A world. So if someone wants to sell their business, they might want to see what's going on first and then engage with advisors, sellers, and so on. So I would definitely recommend taking a look at the content from the Roll Up Europe guys, which is a part of your team. Is obviously engaged with that.
Cool. Well, not really us, but yes, really, really cool content. I can definitely second that. I do take a lot of inspiration from them as well for SaaS Group. So yeah. All right. That's a cool hack.
But I think they're close to you, more or less, right?
Definitely. Absolutely. That's for sure. So yeah, thanks for the shout out. All right. Wonderful. Thank you so much for, you know, for telling the story. and for walking us into like the what's going on the market, because I think that's also very important for founders. It's always a debate, like you said, to sell or not to sell, and how to do it, and who to get on your side to help you. So yeah, now I think there is a bit more clarity. So thank you for that.
Thank you for hosting me. I think it was a good time chatting.
Awesome. Yeah, I enjoyed it. Thank you so much and take care.
That was yet another awesome conversation on SaaS Unbound. We're always looking for new guests to share their experiences. We mostly talk with bootstrapped SaaS founders, and if you're one, reach out to me directly at anna@saas.group or find me on LinkedIn. If you're not bootstrapped or even not SaaS but have a great story to tell, we want to hear from you too. And obviously, SaaS Unbound wouldn't be possible without the SaaS Group, a founder-friendly private equity company that buys awesome businesses that people love to take them to even greater success. If you're thinking about selling your company or just exploring your options, feel free to visit saas.group, fill in the form, and expect a response in under 24 hours.